Services Committee this Thursday, March 31st, 2005. And I want to take a moment to welcome everyone who's joining us in the audience. We're really glad that you're here. We know that some of you came far afield to be able to join with us today, but I appreciate your commitment to not just the legislative measure that we're considering today, but also to alcohol and drug treatment, to the communities from where you come from, and to the families that that benefit from helping folks break the cycle of addiction. And I want to also thank my colleagues, the members of this committee, for taking time out of their busy schedules today to leave the Capitol and come down to Eugene and participate in our tours of the various treatment facilities that we went to. You know, I've found in the legislature that there are so many issues competing for our attention that it's sometimes difficult to spend the time necessary to really understand how our policy is put into practice at the local level. And so one of the things that I wanted to accomplish while I was given the role of the opportunity to lead this committee is to work with really a very experienced panel of legislators here, very talented group here, and use their expertise to sort of go in depth in some of these issues and get a greater level of understanding so that we can bring that back and share with our colleagues the importance of things like the services that you provide. So so that's kind of where we are. And today, for those of you that don't know, we came to Eugene to visit Willamette Family Treatment Center, which is an alcohol and drug treatment center that provides services for men and women in both residential and outpatient settings, and also women and children together, and a detox facility. So really an eye-opening experience. I think we learned a lot. So with that, we have an item on our agenda, House Bill 2500, which is going to basically tighten up some controls over qualified substance abuse treatment programs. We had hoped to get some members of the public to be here. We advertised, I think there was an article in the Register Guard, so if any member of the public shows up on these issues as a whole, we'll welcome their comments. But I also want to say to you that there isn't a special need for you to keep your comments to 2500 in particular. If you had some other perspectives as we're learning about alcohol and drug, feel free to share them in the course of your testimony. So with that, a little bit of public hearing on House Bill 2500, and I'll invite our first panel forward, Damiana Merriweather, Bruce Piper, and Rick Trelevin, is it?
Trelevin,
thank you. So, good evening. Welcome. Thank you for being here, and I'll let you decide if you'd like to proceed.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I'll start. My name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am the lobbyist for the Association of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs here in Oregon, who are community providers of alcohol and drug treatment. And there are several of them here today, and I'll let them introduce themselves and talk to you about the differences and sorts of things that they do. And actually today on the tour, you saw an example of one of our member providers and really the broad spectrum of care that they provide for people who are seeking to recover their lives from addiction and build new lives. So I would like to first just extend our thanks and gratitude for the opportunity to share this with you and to talk to you both about the larger issues of alcohol and drug treatment in Oregon, both our struggles and our victories, as well as talk to you specifically about House Bill 2500. House Bill 2500 was introduced at our request by this committee, actually. Thank you very much. To address what we see as really a shortcoming in some of the state regulations around provision of alcohol and drug treatment services. Right now, if you are a client who comes to treatment through the Department of Human Services programs, if you're directed through child welfare services or through the health plan, and you receive community treatment, you go to a community treatment program, there are requirements as to your licensure and certification of that program. We want to make sure that the folks who are providing the service have demonstrated that they know what they're doing and that they're going to provide a good quality of care that will hopefully help you turn your life around. However, if you come to these services through a different aspect of the state, such as corrections and community corrections, there are not the same standards or requirements that are required of those treatment providers. This is really the legacy of a historical desire of the state to allow community corrections programs to build their overall community corrections design in the way that best suits those communities. And so there's a good reason that reaches back, but the unfortunate result is that we don't have that same minimum standard of requirement. And both Mr. Piper and Mr. Trelevin will be able to talk to you in more detail about their experiences with the variations in that standard from county to county and the impact that that can have. So I will sort of end there and let them talk to you as they have far more knowledge and experience than I do and more interesting, really. the only other things that I will sort of touch on is that in preparation for today's hearing, I have had contacts and conversations with folks at the Association of County Mental Health Programs, seeking their input and making sure that they were aware of what we were doing here and really seeking the opportunity that if they had any questions or concerns to be able to address those constructively. And they, Gina Furman as a representative, came back saying that they affirmatively and strongly support closing up this discrepancy and making for a more consistent standard. I also had communications with the Department of Corrections. We worked with them during the interim when we first began looking at this question and have continued to talk to them once the bill was drafted, and they had much the same response. They've seen this as a shortcoming in the way that the policy is implemented, but have not had the statutory authority to make those changes, so they welcome the changes that would allow them to do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much, Ken.
Well, let me just take a moment. I was remiss in taking a moment earlier to thank you for putting our visit together, our instructional visit, and also to invite a lot of your community partners to participate with us. So thanks for your excellent work.
Okay. I'll get started. My name is Rick Trelevin from Best Care Treatment Services in Central Oregon. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first of all, thank you very much for taking a day out to come down to Central to Eugene and take a look at a treatment center. I mean, I'm just actually very, very impressed that you did that. I'm stunned, frankly. So, so you have a lot of gratitude for me right from there, from the start. A lot of chits you've earned from this person, at least. So any favors you want from here on out, you got it from me. So I've also handed out some printed testimony. But really the testimony I have to give today is to answer the burning question about what's the similarities between a can of beans and a set of OARs, Oregon Administrative Rules. When I started working through college in Representative Dalto's district, I worked for Libby's Bean Cannery. And my first job in the bean cannery was under all the machinery, my job was sweeping up all the reject beans, all the beans that don't get into this can. So that's what we're really talking about is, do we have a mechanism to identify, pick out, and sweep up the reject beans here? Okay? That's what we're really talking about. And they made it, figured it out at Libby's, so we want to do that here too. So what does HB 2500 do? It would require that substance abuse treatment programs that receive state funding, you know, regardless of where that funding stream came from, meet the standards for the Department of Human Services. So a program is deemed to meet these standards if they receive a letter of approval. This is what they look like. This little letter is worth well more than its weight in gold, much, much more. And we all think of it that way. Currently, the standards only apply to programs funded through Department of Human Services. So what's involved in getting this little sweet letter here? a treatment specialist from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services comes out to your site, along with a couple of other people, typically other peers in the field, and they do a site visit that typically takes 2 to 3 days. They pick you through clean. They look at dozens of files. They walk through. They actually measure, you know, in a residential program, they're measuring your rooms. They take a look at your food. They take a look at your health and fire inspections. They give you a good thorough going through. And if that staff person finds that your program has substantially met compliance with the relevant statutes and OARs, then they can recommend a letter of approval for 1, 2, or 3 years. This was a 3-year compliance, so felt really good about that one. And the program needs to be reinspected before your letter of approval is up, because there's a date on this, just like there's a date on this. Okay? After that, we're not sure if it's any good, and we got to reinspect. So is this overly bureaucratic? Is this difficult? I have to say that this thin little document are all the OARs involved for addiction services, 24 and a half pages. In the world of OARs, this is a masterpiece of conciseness. My mental health OARs fit in a binder that looks like that. So, and I listed out in my written testimony everything that's covered in here. All that's covered here is what a well-functioning program should have. Anyways, there's no extra fat in these 24 and a half pages.
Wish we could say that for other OARs.
This is certainly the first time in a public setting that I've said that OARs is a masterpiece of conciseness. I thought I would never live to that day.
Stretch that out a bit.
Yes. So my compliments to those folks. So why is this system important? A system of on-site inspection to set standards ensures that all addiction treatment programs that receive state funding need to meet some basic professional standards. So they don't have to be state-of-the-art Cadillac programs to meet this, but they need to at least be a Chevy. Okay, we're trying to get out the Yugos. These rules set a floor for the quality of services we fund in Oregon. This is the state of Oregon saying that all funded programs shall meet at least this basic standard. We have a soundbite in addiction treatment, and you might have heard it before, that treatment works. As true for all soundbites, reality is a bit more complicated. What we know is that well-designed and professionally delivered treatment will help most people. HB 2500 ensures that programs that receive state funding meet these basic standards for effective services. When we see an unregulated system where there is no agreement upon minimum standard of care, and therefore anything can be called treatment, then the whole treatment field is denigrated. Okay, so I'm very concerned that we have at least a basic minimum standard for everything that we call treatment in this field. What agency would be affected? Luckily, actually, most of the agencies that would be affected want to take advantage of contracting with an already licensed agency. They see those advantages. We've seen a handful of instances where that hasn't occurred. It would primarily affect some contracts within Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority, as far as I can figure out. And impact to a much lesser degree, and I can't find any examples where it would impact, but it could impact Commission on Children and Families and Department of Education. For all these programs, the impact would be relatively minor because most of the time they already require that programs have the DHS letter of approval. It's just sometimes they don't. So we're trying to clean up that little loophole. What would be the cost of implementing this? This is a nice part these days. There would be no cost for implementing HB 2500. Most addiction programs already function under a letter of approval from DHS, and we already function under this. And all counties have such programs. HB 2500 simply requires that if a program is to receive state funding, they need to comply with these standards. So I'll accept any questions at this point from the committee.
Representative Cameron.
Rich, you said that there's very few. Do we know how many that would need to go and get this certification?
I was actually, our plan was to have Mr. Piper answer that question as the next part of the testimony. We don't know the exact numbers because the system is pretty diversified, so we haven't been able to figure out all the contracts. I have been able to find two to three to four examples that I can find, but I'm not sure about that. And I think Bruce has done a bit more study on that.
We'll just wait for his testimony.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Greenlee, could you?
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make a statement rather than a question. I'm so impressed with what you had said about treatment works, that well-designed and professionally delivered treatment will help most people. Very accurate, wonderful, concise statement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Rick, I picked up a little on the fact that you're talking about really seeking highly qualified people to work with the addictions. We've noticed in Southern Oregon that there have been several programs that have come and gone. Is it funding only? Is it quality? Tell me a little bit about what your problems in Bend or around the state that you see in programs that kind of dry up or close up and we don't see them again.
This will be my personal assessment as opposed to president of ADAPAO and whatnot, is my philosophy around management is that there's three key areas of management of a nonprofit. One is your financial bottom line. Two is making sure you deliver quality services. And three is your community relationships and that they all interact and all work together. And so if your community relationships are poor, then probably your quality of services and your bottom line is going to be poor. If your quality of services are poor, then the other two affect it. And if your bottom line is getting shrinking, then the other two will be impacted. One of the things, so in the long run, you know, year after year, decade after decade, I think those three elements pay attention to that as far as individual management. What we're beginning to see with the severe cuts in the last session is, especially in the metro area and some of the other areas, we're seeing a number of programs merge. Some programs are disappearing. And then parts of programs, I've had to close parts of my services down, intensive women's services, intensive outpatient women's services, which we had a thriving program. I had to shut that thing down. So if I were a much smaller agency, that would have killed me. But I'm a large enough agency that was able to draw on different funding. So I think those are some elements that I'm paying attention to currently in the system, and I know some providers have personally told me that they are just hanging on by fingernails.
Follow-up. So a good part of it is funding. Do you have a problem in getting qualified people? Are there good training programs? And where would that be, at universities or?
Over the last few years, the colleges and especially the community colleges had stepped up to the plate pretty well to provide good training opportunities. The problem is that the pay that we're able to pay folks I'm doing pretty good because I'm able to offer a a position for my CADC, my certified drug and alcohol counselors, starting pay is at $12 an hour, and I'm doing pretty good on that. But that's not exactly what you're going to draw folks with master's degree into. So, you know, in the long run, you know, I get some gems. You know, there's some counselors I have that are just, you know, I don't deserve them for what I'm paying them. But in the long run, my observation is you get what you pay for. Anyone who runs a business knows that. There are lots of exceptions, but you do get what you pay for in the long run.
Okay. Thank you. Bruce, you want to go ahead?
Sure.
Thank you.
I actually have something to pass out.
Great. Thank you, Bruce.
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I too want to thank you for having this hearing here. Those of us in Southern Oregon, I think Representative Anderson can testify, have worn a well-worn groove up I-5 to Salem. This is the first time I ever remember a hearing being held down here.
Can I just have you say your name?
Bruce Piper. I'm the CEO of ADAPT in Roseburg. We also have a presence in Coos Bay and in Grants Pass. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Treatment Network, which has several member agencies and subcontractors combined deliver service, alcohol and drug treatment services from a little over 40 sites throughout Oregon, from Baker City to Portland and then basically down the valley to Southern Oregon. I feel a little bit apologetic about this bill because as I read it, I can't imagine a more boring bill of all the thousands that you have to look at. Rick characterized it as...
Don't worry about that.
No.
Not in the top 10.
Thank you. Okay. Rick characterized it as housekeeping, and I would agree with that characterization. A little, I think, relevant history about the administrative rules. You seemed a little surprised at Rick's comments that were favorable about these administrative rules. Well, for about 16 years, our association meetings were dominated by very bitter criticism about administrative rules. They were unbelievably cumbersome, overwrought, ran us around in circles, were very costly, basically helped flush people out of the field because they got so tired clinically of the amount of documentation that was required to try to provide a human service. And several years ago, we as an association, along with some other folks, asked for a budget note, and were successful in that. And the Ways and Means Committee attached a budget note requiring, at that time, ODAP, the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, to take a look at the administrative rules with an eye toward streamlining them. And I was part of a committee. There's other people in the room that were part of the committee that spent a lot of time in Salem working on that. And the outcome was what Rick described. What we have now, I think, is administrative rules that don't define what a Mercedes looks like. They define, I think, properly, and the choice we had as a committee was, do we define absolutely what the perfect, best treatment program is going to look like? And we all knew that that was kind of stupid. And so the real task was, where do we set the bar where everybody ought to get their nose over the bar to make sure that there's an acceptable level of accountability and solid treatment that's being offered? That's what we came up with. And I was thinking about it this morning and kind of astonished myself to realize I can't remember one single provider in the last 5 years that has said anything to me that's critical of our existing administrative rules. That's pretty amazing. That really is. And I don't think that there would be anybody out there that would say, no, they don't define an acceptable level. So I think we're in a good place with where we're at with the existing OARs. The field, the industry as a whole, I think, is overall supportive of where they're at. I looked at this bill and thought, what's the question here? And I tried to frame some pertinent questions, and they're listed there in front of you. Why wouldn't we want all publicly funded services to meet agreed-upon minimum standards? As an association of providers, we think that we should. Do we want the same service provided in two different places to be governed by OARs in one place but not in the other? I don't think that's good practice. If we were agreeable to using public funds to provide services without minimum standards, well, then why require the minimum standard somewhere else? It just it doesn't make sense to us. We see this again as an issue that's historic, but its time has come when if you provide alcohol and drug treatment in Oregon using public funds, wherever the public funds may have come from, there ought to be some minimum standards that apply to that. Right now, and Rick alluded to this a little bit, if you're using public funds from some other system other than DHS, you can provide treatment without paying any attention to the regulatory license that Rick is talking about. We'd like to close that loophole and make sure that there are minimum standards for all of us and it's a level playing field. We see this bill as a spiritual kin to the evidence-based practice law passed last session, Senate Bill 267. You build evidence-based practices on top of a fundamental foundation that defines what the minimum standards ought to be. That's what we see this bill doing, really not anything else. The question came up earlier, Representative Cameron. I can think of contracts that I've had some oversight responsibility over the last 5 or 6 years, 7 or 8 examples where someone has been operating for some period of time knowingly and chose not to basically go after a letter of approval. And those were in a variety of different settings. I responded to an OAA RFP within the last couple of weeks where no mention.
OAA?
Oregon Youth Authority.
OAA.
I'm sorry. Thank you. There's no mention. If you are a certified counselor, you can contract for public funds and provide that service. What we're used to is having the infrastructure that Rick described in his testimony laying out minimum standards for you to follow. Is that responsive to your question?
Sure.
Representative? Okay. Good. I could also take a swing at your question, Representative Anderson. I'll use one example. I was approached about 3 years ago about providing services in Coos County. Now, we have for years provided services in Reedsport, which is 20 minutes north on the coast. And in I've worked at this agency and been since 1981, been the administrator since 1986. And during that span, at one point in time, I was the Reedsport counselor. So I personally used to drive over an hour and a half to the coast at least once a week to provide services over there. And we've watched Coos County kind of writhe over the years in what you were alluding to. I've watched 9 nonprofit organizations go out of business there trying to provide alcohol and drug services over the last 20 years. The community finally came to me in Roseburg and said, would you please come over here and help? Because as of next June, we will not have any provider whatsoever, period. The last one has given notice and is going out of business. What I said to them at the time, I went over and I met with judges, I met with the mental health authority, I met with some people in the community, I met with law enforcement. I said, you know, your business practices, there's so little money in terms of forming an economic core to do business. I mean, this is a competitive business model with not much money to fight over. And if there was a lot of money to be made here, there would be a lot of for-profit entities belling up to the bar coming after this. That's not the case. That's just not the way it works. So what you have is a relatively small pie that keeps getting sliced up in several ways. And I said, be happy to come over here, be happy to do this, but you need to sort of consolidate this somewhat to give anybody, us or anybody else, a chance to do this. What it looked like in those agencies was that they weren't managed well. The reality was, I don't think anybody could do it over time. The business environment really didn't allow that to happen. And Coos County's changed that. They have contracted with us. The health plan has contracted with us. We have enough of a core there where we've, you know, done, a decent job for the last 3 years and hope to continue to do that. A word about methamphetamine. I'll tell you, Senator Wyden is having a town hall meeting tomorrow in Roseburg. It was laid on in a hurry, and I have a staff person that's going to speak at it tomorrow. And all of what I hear coming out of Washington, D.C., and a lot of what I read in the paper about coming out of Salem, about methamphetamine really scares me, because we have so much demand for our services we can't meet now, that as I keep hearing over and over and over again about enhancing the ability of law enforcement to further prosecute and go after people, I just keep thinking we are not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We do not have the treatment capacity. One of the very few areas in this state where we've been able to effectively deal with methamphetamine is in drug courts. And I saw Judge Larson in the room, and he, I'm sure, will eloquently speak to this. The primary difference, or one of the primary differences that I have experienced having been a drug court provider, is it's the only place in the Oregon system right now where we have a very long length of stay. There's enough resources that come together at that we oftentimes have a length of stay of a year and a half, 2 years. It depends on the drug court. The judges do things differently. But that is a huge aspect of being successful in treating methamphetamine addicts. The National Institute of Drug Abuse has very clear brain scans showing what these physiological brain damage looks like with brain scans, and you can see over a period of months as people abstain, the brains start to heal. Well, if you have a length of stay of 4 months, you're not very far in that process. And if you look at the state of Oregon CPMS data from the Department of Human Services, the length of stay generally in outpatient treatment is not very long. And that's partly because we're faced with lots of demand at the front door. How do we meet the demand? If we don't get people in quickly, we violate our contract. Our community partners get very unhappy with us if we're not responsive. The only way you can do that is open the front door wide, but the back door's open pretty wide, too. You let people go pretty quickly. And essentially what you're doing is you're thinning the soup to try to be responsive to the community, but your length of stay is not really what you need it to be anywhere near as effective as you want to be, especially with methamphetamine. The one other thing I'd say about that is that if you look at a long length of stay and if you look at intensity, our residential treatment system in this state for men is unbelievably thin now. There are very few men that can access treatment. And as a result of that, that puts even more of a burden on the outpatient system, because we're trying to treat people that ought to be in the residential system or services first for, in some instances, an extended period of time. We're trying to do that in outpatient. We have a jail program now in Roseburg, and have had for the last couple of years, where we have a minimum 6-month length of stay. It's a great way to do treatment on the cheap. They're already in jail. All we got to do is, all of the infrastructure costs are already borne by the jail. They're going to be there. All we need to do is provide some good clinical staff inside the jail and work with the jail staff to do that. Done that marvelously effective. We've had 55 graduates in the last a little over 2.5 years, and I think so far we've had one reoffense out of that. And I would love for you as a committee to sit down and talk to a dozen of these graduates, many of whom have, a year and a half to 2 years now clean and sober, and there's probably not a more inspiring experience that you'll have to listen to them talk about what their life was like, what their life is like now after treatment. It's why we keep being in this business, frankly. It's an unbelievably positive human interest story.
Thank you. Bruce, thank you for coming tonight, and thank you for wearing that groove in I-5. You've been very diligent, all of you, in keeping us informed. The chair's given us a little room to go afield tonight, and you've talked to me in the past about an issue about being able to bid for services in your county. I wonder if you could put on the record the issue that's been troubling you in that area.
For my first 20 years in the field here or so, if you're a nonprofit organization, any time the state put any kind of money out for bid, a nonprofit organization could bid on it. And something changed in about 99 or 2000, where at that point in time, the only eligible bidders were defined by law as a tribe or a county. And I personally think that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think that probably some of you as legislators have served on nonprofit boards of community agencies. and you work like your tail off to develop specific services and have a five-year plan to meet the needs of the community, and then lo and behold, some dollars become available and you want to go for it. Well, you know, if somebody in your county has a different idea, you don't even get to apply. It just doesn't make sense to me, and I want to emphasize that what I'm talking about there would not in any way undo the fact that the Department of Human Services primarily contracts with counties. Even if, in our experience, even if we bid, we don't get the, generally most of us don't get the money directly. It goes to the county and then is subcontracted by the county. Fine. My issue is, and that's shared by many of my colleagues, is we'd like just the opportunity to be able to bid and for our community to then receive the money, and then usually it would be subcontracted to us.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bruce, you said there's 7-8. I just want to go back to that, the certificate. It takes 2 to 3 days to come in and have somebody do an inspection. And you said there's no cost to this on those 7 or 8 people or those 10 people. Is Department of Human Services the responsible, and they have the staff? Have you, as
right,
somebody talked about, they're not going to come into our committee and say, hey, you know, you're going to pass this bill, now it's going to cost us 3 more positions to...
No, the numbers of extra programs to inspect would probably equal about the number of programs that are going out of business because of lack of funding. So I think we probably have a flat...
That's not good. And then is there a cost... Is there a cost to the individual... organization for that letter?
No.
There.
No. The only cost that we don't pay the state for the inspection, but we work our buns off to make sure that we are meet the standards. And so the only cost is ensuring that your program meets those standards.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative. Sure, can I ask a quick question, Bruce? I'm still trying to understand what your response was to Representative Greenlich's question. So you're saying that the money from the state goes to the county and then goes to the treatment programs, and you're saying that you cannot bid for those monies? No, you're not saying.
Correct. The ORS was changed in 99 or 2000, right in there. It was the first time we noticed it. We had been applying to our state our RFPs for a couple of decades, and then all of a sudden we no longer by law were eligible. We were defined out of eligibility by law. So if you look in the existing ORS, and I can't remember the citation, 680.357 or something, it defines eligibility only as a county, a combination of counties, or a tribe.
And Damiana, can you respond to that term so you're nodding your head here? Do you have any more information on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. And actually, we've been looking at what those options were since Bruce was really the first one to bring it to broad attention, and Representative Greenlich has been looking for a way to find a vehicle that might be able to remedy that situation since it came up after a date when we could introduce bills.
Okay, thanks.
I'm looking for a spare relating clause.
May I follow
yeah,
up?
Oh, please do.
Thank you. So, please, I want to make sure that I understand, too, your concern when you're talking about the senator coming to Roseburg and talking a lot about methamphetamine. You're concerned, I'm sort of having a hard time understanding. Your point is that more people should be going to the drug courts rather than being put into jail. I'm sort of lost there.
My concern is what I see happening at the federal and at the state level from what I'm reading in the Oregonian is that so much of the emphasis is on interdiction rather than demand reduction, i.e. so much of it is on law enforcement related and prosecutorial functions. And believe me, we're very supportive of that. But somewhere there's a balance there. When we look at what we have seen happen to treatment capacity, And we feel very heavily the weight of being the entity in the community to successfully treat these folks, and we can't deal with what we have now, creating additional folks in the criminal justice system that will also need these services needs to be thought about, and because we need more capacity to treat them if that's what's going to happen. Drug court is one great way of treating them. It's only one of many ways to treat folks, and I would, and a lot of my colleagues would say, we can do a very good job with an awful lot of these people through drug courts and through other, through residential treatment, through intensive outpatient. We know how to treat methamphetamine addiction. We can't do a very good job of it right now because of the volume of people that we need. We keep having to thin the soup.
Which is just going to continue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And, Bruce, I'm really glad that you brought that up because I guess one of the reasons why I wanted to even bring this committee to an alcohol and drug treatment facility in my sort of imprecise and clumsy sort of learning way is that, you know, I have this sense that we can throw all the resources we have and bankrupt ourselves in trying to put people in jail you know, deal with in a reactive sort of way to a problem that doesn't seem seems to continue to increase, or we can partner with our community alcohol and drug partners to try to get it handled in a proactive way much earlier before it becomes a real problem. And so I think that's what I had hoped to accomplish by this effort and some more efforts that we'll undertake to learn about how we can be more effective in the prevention side. And so that's I'm encouraged by your comments. I have a couple of questions, but actually I'll wait. Representative Greenlee, did you have
a question? Thank you.
Then I have a couple of questions then that were prompted by your testimony. I'm sorry, I looked to Representative Greenlee for guidance often, so if you hear me asking him, he just stares at me, so I said okay. But
you didn't have to wait for you.
But first of all, I think what I hear you saying in response to Representative Tomei's comments were along the lines of the drug court, were that if we arrest somebody because of a drug situation, they are arrested, they are perhaps prosecuted, perhaps not, perhaps pleaded out, perhaps given a very short sentence, but a very short time to try to touch that person and change that behavior, as opposed to perhaps a drug court, which is maybe not as intensive in terms of putting them in jail and keeping them in a bed, but a longer opportunity to be sort of overseen by that kind of system. Is that what you're getting at?
Drug court is one of the places in the system where you have sort of a constellation of resources coming together. You've got the judiciary, you've got criminal justice, you've got treatment, and each of them bring some resources to the table. Mm-hmm. And it has evolved as a model that has a very high level of accountability and both sanctions and rewards. The other thing that's a huge aspect of drug courts is that unlike a lot of people that come through the system, there's an immediacy factor to it. Typically the way the system is set up in any county where there's a drug court is not very long after a person is cited or arrested, they end up in front of the judge. Think about it. All of us have had kids. You realize you try to discipline a kid, you know, 3 weeks after they did something, it doesn't work very well. You want to pair that as closely with the behavior that was a problem as you possibly can. Drug courts are a way to do that. I'm not sure I completely understood your question, but I'm thinking that part of what might be confusing to you is that's one service. We have lots and lots of other people coming in our door that aren't part of the criminal justice system that also have methamphetamine problems. We can't begin to treat the number of people on parole and probation. In my community in Roseburg, there's 1,000 to 1,100 people under supervision, parole and probation. Every single one of those POs and the managers will tell us, have told us for years, 80% of them are strongly alcohol and drug involved. At any given time, we may have 100 to 125, 130 that are being treated. Okay, the rest of them, they're trying to supervise. They're doing sporadic UAs on, and some of those folks are running wild. And we think, from our view of the world, that it's a better investment overall for community safety and for Oregonians to have more of those people involved in treatment, where they're getting UAID on a random basis, very often, 3-4 times a month or more, where they're required to be going to self-help meetings, where their family is engaged in the process, where, you know, we're on them. And the child welfare referrals, we average about 177, 180 kids in foster care in Douglas County per month for the last 12 months. We're up to 261 today. Child welfare tells us almost all of those are due to methamphetamine. So, you know, the need is just glaring at us at the community level. And, again, we just feel so heavily this weight of we know we're a huge part of the solution. We can be. We want to continue to be. We need, you know, hate to say it, bottom line is we need some resources to be able to do that.
Okay. So does that mean that we have a plan then that sort of a comprehensive plan that will tell us how much resources we have? Maybe that's a does that seem like that might be an appropriate place to start?
Representative Dalto and members of the committee, I served on with Judge Larson on the Governor's Methamphetamine Task Force. If you want a comprehensive blueprint, we produced it there, and there were very clearly three parts to addressing the problems of methamphetamine listed out there. The three legs of the stool: law enforcement, prevention, treatment. Our concern is, at this point, what's been put forward in the legislature has been one leg of that stool, law enforcement. We've seen nothing constructive on prevention nor on treatment. So I think we will run into making the same mistakes that we initially made with the crack epidemic back in the 80s. So we're trying to prevent that to give us a comprehensive and logical process about how to address that.
Okay, but you're pointing us to the governor's task force on meth, and my understanding is that perhaps that didn't go beyond meth, and maybe that's the biggest component of the problem right now, or the most exigent component of the problem. But I'm just wondering if we have an overall plan as a whole. As I'm sort of learning here, you know, the differences between the folks that are sort of criminally sort of affected, and then the folks that are just coming in privately that don't have criminal access, and it might be drugs, it might be alcohol, or it might be, you know, a combination. I guess I don't hear that we have an overall comprehensive plan.
Well, we're both stunned.
Okay.
Believe me, we given the opportunity. To be very blunt, we're so used to trying to scratch a way to have a place at the table to say what we've said today that we're not used to having somebody ask, what's the plan? But it's not that we lack ideas.
Go ahead.
Actually, the answer
is... Can I just tell you, I'm not here to waste my time or anybody else's time. It's like, hey, I got a checklist of things to do. A&D is one of them. And you might say, oh, my God, you got to just be one thing on the checklist. Yeah.
Okay, just make a comment.
Please do.
And, you know, I really appreciate it. I really am intrigued with these people's perspective. I have a proposal to create a drug policy coordinator at the state level to deal with these issues with interdiction, law enforcement, prevention, and treatment. Now, some of the problems seems to be the silos that we have. And do you think something at the state level like that would be useful in helping us move towards a coordinated plan?
Two things. Let me first answer Representative Dalto's, and then I'll be in a position to answer your question, Representative Greenlick. Is the past, we've had comprehensive plans in the past driven out of the state with input from the community. The last couple of years have really been about retrenchment and survival. What we've lost in the last couple of years, and we end up feeling like the hole in the donut here, is intensive outpatient services, which is the critical element that we need. It survives in bits and pieces, but it's a fraction of what it was. The answer, we at one point historically had a cabinet-level position with the agency that no longer exists,
ODAP.
How soon we forget. And that person, who is Jeff Kushner for many years, really rode herd over the executive branch, trying to create those linkages. Since that disappeared, though we and was merged with OMHAS, and even though we have, I think, one of the finest directors of OMHAS that we could ever hope for, his plate is very, very full, and I think your suggestion would be very good. And really, my concern is that it doesn't just get captured by law enforcement issues, that it really is someone who can look at all three legs of that stool and cross silos. And it's probably going to be dependent upon the governor's emphasis and who they appoint to that position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee, I think we'll spend some time exploring that that concept at our first opportunity. Thank you for bringing it forward. Representative Boone.
I'm interested in the prevention piece and what you would advise for that. What the task force has put forth. Did you say nobody has forwarded any legislation that picks up prevention?
Correct. From those recommendations have not been put forward into the committees, as far as I know. Is that true?
Can you just maybe give us a couple of examples of what they were?
I'm drawing a blank. I didn't come prepared to address. Oh, and Judge Larson is here, and he might be able to speak to some of that as I'm drawing a blank. I'm prepared for that. Basically, I think what we're looking at is prevention has developed tremendously over the last 10 years. There's some very clear evidence-based practices that we can plug in, and we're wanting to have that clearly done in the communities around Oregon. We spend very, very little general fund dollars. Most of the funding for prevention is federal at this point. So it's continuing that, adding anything we can to that pot. It's very cost effective because the most effective means of doing this is not paying staff to do it. You know, we have a prevention coordinator, which is important, but what they really do is organize community groups. And I have a prevention coordinator in one of my counties who's just dynamite, the kind of folks that she's been able to pull in and keep involved and keep excited, and the kind of activity she's able to pull off in Jefferson County is just amazing. And so it's being able to keep that going. And I can tell you, in Jefferson County, we are flooded with meth, and we need it desperately. So
one comment I would make about that is that if you think about prevention as being general prevention, like throughout the school that you might be doing prevention activities in, or very targeted prevention, you can't get a more targeted prevention program for methamphetamine than to treat mothers of young children who are hooked on crank or who are pregnant. In our outpatient services, we've had over the years over 100 infants born to women who came in the door with a dirty UA and had their baby delivered drug-free during the time they were in treatment. Now, you can crunch all kinds of numbers at Dornbecker as to how much, you know, drug-impaired infants cost and all that kind of stuff. And, it produces some eye-popping numbers. But one of the things we say in treatment a lot is, geez, I mean, at least with prevention, there's a generalized prevention, and some of us do that, and then there's some targeted prevention. And working with some of these families with these kids is a huge part of what we think about as prevention.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it at that for this panel, but I want to thank you very much. Really a thought-provoking discussion, and there was a question that I wanted to ask you. I'll just put it on the record, and then maybe we can get it offline, but I was wondering, sort of on a separate note, what the treatment landscape looks like for our minority communities in this state, and I imagine that the picture is probably not a bright one. So maybe we can talk afterwards online.
Sure.
Thank you very much. And it was pointed out to me that I forgot to ask the members to introduce themselves. So maybe we can just go down the line and just say where you're from and whatever you'd like to say. Representative Boone.
I'm Deborah Boone, and I'm from House District 32, which is the upper left coast, Clatsop, Tillamook counties, western Washington County, a little piece of Columbia County.
I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I'm from Milwaukee and southeast Portland.
I'm Billy Dalton. I represent Oregon's 21st House District in Salem, and I am in my second term.
Kevin Cameron from Salem, Marion County, Turner, Almsville area, and I'm the newest of the 60 House of Representatives.
And I'm Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. That's northwest Portland, the Multnomah and Washington County unincorporated suburban area, and rural Helvetia. So I'm... I have a district that looks very much like the state in terms of its mix.
I'm Gordon Anderson. I represent District 3, which is Grants Pass, Cave Junction, Josephine County.
Thanks very much. And colleagues, evidently we have some food, some sandwiches here. I don't know what you want to do. Sandy could
later
bring them over here, yeah, or we could do them later, whatever you want to do. But they're available if you want
to. I vote for sooner. Later.
Okay. All right.
Sooner.
So we'll just keep working. Please excuse us for taking that break. But anyway, Judge Larson would like to invite you forward, please.
Good evening.
Good evening. Welcome.
My name is Darrell Larson. I'm a circuit judge in Lane County, and I want to give you a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I will, at 7 o'clock, magically turn into a toad because today is my wife's birthday, and there's a party at 7 o'clock, and if I'm not there, I'm a toad.
Okay.
I'm probably toast, too. A little bit about my background. First of all, I was a prosecutor in the DA's office here for about 19 years, briefly went to work in Salem during the Michael Franke disaster, and looked at the corrections division and did some investigating about what happened there and what we ought to do about it. Worked with now District Attorney Foote in terms of what to do about the penitentiary system in terms of drugs. And I think we had great success. That's a story for a different day. For the last 15 years, I've been a circuit judge here in Lane County, and Jeff Kushner's name came up, Bruce, or somebody mentioned it. He is the person who is responsible for putting me in the miserable circumstance I now find myself in, being a drug court judge, because in December of 1993, Jeff called me and asked, he basically browbeat me into going to something that was referred to as the First National Drug Courts Conference in Miami. And Miami is the place where they started and dreamed up the first drug court. And I didn't know what a drug court was, and I didn't much care, and my wife wasn't going to be very happy with me leaving for a week during the Christmas holidays. So I told him I didn't want to go, but Jeff being what he was, I ended up going. And I'm really glad to this day that I did, because what I saw there was a group of about several hundred people. There were maybe 10 or 12 drug courts in the country at the time, and the feds had basically flown in everybody because they felt like something very seriously good was happening with this thing called drug court. And what I saw were people that had been in the system, as professionals for 10, 15, 20 years, and instead of being incredibly pessimistic and frustrated, their eyes were twinkling and they were incredibly positive about what they were doing and what they were accomplishing. And it became obvious to me that this thing they're referring to, drug court, is the criminal justice equivalent of the Post-it. It's like, why didn't I think of that? I could have been living in Maui, you know, in some palatial mansion somewhere with servants all day. It's really so incredibly simple. It's really beyond belief. And I think the people behind me who just testified did a pretty good job of giving you a thumbnail of what's going on with that. But I want to touch on some other things. One of the things that I've actually done, as Trill Evans said, was be on the Governor's Meth Task Force. And I found myself ending up as the chair of the treatment subcommittee of the Meth Task Force. And in that regard, our particular focused goal was to try to figure out what is going on with treatment, what ought to go on with treatment, where are we short, where do we need to go, How can we do it cost effectively? How do we squeeze the maximum amount of effectiveness, both in terms of outcomes and in terms of the public tax dollar, out of the system we refer to as treatment in the state of Oregon? I think we did as best we could do in making some recommendations to the governor, hopefully that would be forwarded to the legislature, about how to do that with respect to the treatment subsection of that three-legged stool. I wish I could had come a little better prepared in terms of the prevention issue, because that's another substantial subject that would take us a long time to cover. And, you know, Kayleen Deathridge is the person really to talk to from the Oregon Partnership about that. And if you call Craig Prinz at Criminal Justice, I think you can, you know, quickly get any information you need and point it in the right direction as to who to talk to. But she is an absolute goldmine of prevention resource.
Kayleen Deathridge.
And the Oregon Partnership really has put together an incredibly great system of wonderful ideas that are smart, they're cost-effective, they are effective, research-effective, and they have been basically largely funded by private enterprise in the state of Oregon to get corporations and businesses behind these initiatives on a local basis, and then to replicate those into communities all over the state. In the places where we've found they actually work and work pretty well, it's easy for another community to say to somebody that's already doing it, how did you do that? Use the model and just replicate it in their community. And I think we can really make some incredible strides with respect to prevention. But the truth of the matter is that the place where people, by and large, learn to do methamphetamine or any other drug is in the home. And, you know, these people that we call criminal offenders are human beings. And they aren't just doing one particular crime that got them in trouble and they happen to be a drug addict. They probably, if they're hooked on meth, they are extremely sexually active people. I mean, one of the effects of methamphetamine is to hypersexualize you. And so you virtually never go into anybody's house who's a meth addict without finding all kinds of pornography and, you know, trashy stuff on their computers, dirty magazines, and all the rest of the stuff you would expect with that. Well, their kids are living in the middle of this. You know, what are their kids coming out like? The answer is they're becoming drug meth addicts. You wouldn't believe the number of people I hear in court every day as a drug court judge now. So, you know, we have them fill out this form when they come into drug court, and one of the things they write down is anybody else who's using drugs in the home, and it's almost always yes. And when did you start first using drugs? And the answer is, you know, early teens, maybe 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age. Alcohol, marijuana, methamphetamine, oftentimes given to them by their parents or parental figures being boyfriends or girlfriends, usually boyfriends, because the women usually end up with, you know, the responsibility of having the children, and a series of male relationships, all of whom are meth addicts. And we are just, as a state, festering this problem, and we are teaching the rest of the country what it looks like when you have bigger and bigger quantities of people who are addicted to methamphetamine. And we are doing that because we are really focusing, in my view, having the perspective of a prosecutor and a judge now, of looking at the wrong things. I'm not anti-law enforcement. I was the lawyer for law enforcement for many, many years, and a lot of my friends still are cops and prosecutors. But you just cannot arrest your way out of this particular problem. If you do a better job of being a police officer and making cases in the first place, and then making good cases secondly, that's what we pay the officers to do. But then they process those people through the courts, and what do the courts do with them? Well, you expect me to get a good public safety outcome, right? I mean, there's no reason to arrest anybody unless it's for public safety. That's the whole point. But how do we get a public safety outcome that's optimal? If we're dealing with 80% of the people that come into the criminal justice system, i.e. the courts, as addicts, we've got two choices. We can either treat them or lock them up. If we lock them up, first of all, it's expensive as hell to lock somebody up. We can't do it because of methamphetamine for a long enough period of time to have any meaningful effect on them. the best we can do is maybe slow down their addiction, dry them out enough to where they can at least listen to you and get some information into their head that may make some degree of sense. And that has huge value if the next stage is treatment. But what we're doing is we're constantly cutting back on treatment, and as people get more and more frustrated, legislators included, with, you know, the identity thefts, the car clouts, burglaries, all the rest of the incredible property crime that these people have to commit to get the money to do their methamphetamine, we get more and more frustrated with that, and we get more and more angry about it and want to lock people up. You know, your legislators, you know you haven't got the money to do that. We simply do not have the money to do that. If we had unbelievable amounts of money, I'd say, if you want to lock people up until they finally dry out and then deal with them, fine. The trouble with that logic is that if you go in an addict, you come out an addict. I mean, we've got people in the penitentiary consistently that go in for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, and guess what? The 2 months before they get out, they start thinking about where their next connection is going to be to their methamphetamine connection. I mean, what a terrible loss of the public's money if that's what we end up with. We really need to think about this in terms of public safety. And I don't care whether you're on the far left as a, you know, bleeding heart do-gooder from a human point of view, or you're on the extreme right in terms of wanting to really hammer these people and not spend any money on drug addicts. The bottom line is, if you're dealing with an addict, it's no different than dealing with somebody who's got diabetes. If we said, it is against the law for your blood sugar to be out of whack, and you get caught with your blood sugar out of whack, you get 30 days in the slammer, would any of us expect this person to come out without diabetes at the end? Absolutely not. It's ridiculous. Well, it's exactly the same with methamphetamine. And it's even more, actually, any drug. But methamphetamine really raises the stakes. And that's really why I said yes to being on the governor's meth task force, because it is the problem for this state. And let me give you one example. The federal government has done some looking at how many people are in treatment for various kinds of drugs around the country. And Oregon was one of all the states were looked at with respect to these drugs. Oregon's rate of treatment per 100,000 was 119 people higher than the next highest state for methamphetamine. And we rank fourth in the country from the bottom for treatment access. Now, you put those two statistics together, and it tells you, it gives you some measure of how bad the methamphetamine problem is in the state of Oregon. And I got to say that it's one of the reasons I think it's getting that bad is because we've really, really cut back on the money going into treatment. And there really is no other way for me as a judge or for that police officer on the street to deal with this person if they're addicted to meth or any other drug. To effectively deal and give you a good public safety outcome unless this person gets treated. That is the bottom line. Whether you like it or not, that's the reality of the situation. And as a judge, you know, I sit up there and I got this person in front of me. Let's say I'm not doing drug court. I'm just sitting there as a regular sentencing judge. Person comes in, he's convicted, he or she's convicted. I sentence them. What am I going to do to them? If they're not going to the penitentiary because it's below the dispositional line on the grid, for sentencing guidelines, they're going to get probation and some minimal amount of jail time, frankly. They do a few days in jail. In many counties, they get matrixed out before even the full measure of the jail, you know, under sentencing guidelines, because there's just not enough space to keep them all. And many jails are in a jail cap situation for federal government. They're on probation. Probation officers got so many people, they can't even really look at them meaningfully. And so if this person's addicted, I mean, basically their full-time job is to get high. Is that a solution for the next car clout and the next arrest and the next prosecution? I mean, it's just a lose-lose proposition from the taxpayer's point of view. And I'd like to really have this looked at from that point of view. I think there is no reason to do law enforcement on property crimes and drug offenders unless what we're interested in is getting a good public safety outcome. And we are dealing with way too many people coming through the courts who are addicted to drugs, and particularly methamphetamine, which is a long-term problem with serious brain implications. And we are going to have to just simply put some money into treatment to get good public safety outcomes. Now, that's bad news in terms of that in itself, but it is very good news in terms of the cost-effectiveness of treatment. As Rick or maybe Bruce said, treatment does work. And one of the things I've noticed, and this is maybe an admission of sorts, with drug court, the pay for treatment counselors is so lousy that we frankly can't keep them for very long. And so there's a very high rate of turnover in treatment counselors. Now, that's a problem for a long-term program like a drug court. I mean, I'm expecting a minimum, basically, 1 year time in drug court for the people that come into our drug court. Their counselor may change three times in spite of the fact we've redesigned the system to have one counselor follow the person all the way through, which is no mean feat because they're changing phases of their treatment all the time. But what I've noticed, and I was gone from drug court for 3 years. I did it for 6 years, then I was gone for 3 years. Now I'm just back in January. One of the things I noticed is that the methodology for treatment has improved so dramatically in that time period that since I've been gone, that even with counselors who really aren't probably that talented, they get unbelievably good outcomes because the treatment really does work. It has been researched and proven to be effective with people. And so my job, frankly, I know the treatment providers are going to give us a good public safety outcome in terms of this person getting off drugs and not reoffending if I can keep them in treatment. And so my job from the criminal justice point of view is to make darn sure they're showing up for treatment, because if their hiney is in that chair for a long enough period of time, we will get a pretty good outcome. And the public will get a pretty good outcome because their criminality is declined, their drug usage is declined, their physical and mental functioning goes up, their responsibility for their children goes up, we make sure they get employed because we want to get paid for our treatment, and the taxpayers start getting some money paid in instead of the other way around. So it's a really good combination of outcomes.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You want the treatment. We have no funding. Are there ways that we could access the assets of some of these people like they did with Little Rico or things like that, or is that not?
I've got to say, what assets? I mean, your car stereo?
They have cars. They have.
They don't, really. Okay. Most of them don't have driver's licenses. And, I mean, the financial level of the huge bulk of people I see coming through the criminal justice side, you know, and these guys are right. There's a lot of people who are seeking treatment who never get arrested. They're seeking treatment voluntarily. Maybe their families push them into it, or they just get so sick and tired of being sick and tired they actually try to get some treatment. But treatment's difficult when you're doing it voluntarily, because if you can walk in, you can also walk out. And so when the going gets tough, I mean, I'm sure these guys will tell you that it's hard sometimes to keep people in treatment because it's very, very difficult to do.
So any funding would have to come after recovery?
We squeeze people for money, and we squeeze them to get jobs even if they're not very meaningful or well-paid jobs. I mean, if we get $10 per time per week, it's some money. I think the bottom line is you've got to look at this as a business deal. You're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on penitentiaries. How much of a percentage of the DOC budget does it really take to do treatment for hundreds of people? You know, if what you're doing is going to cost you, put you in a situation where you have to build another $100 million institution versus putting in a few million dollars to the treatment system to dissipate the need for that new institution, it seems to me it's an awfully good business decision. And I think I am a person who has become fairly liberal on the human side but very conservative on the money side. And I would like to see both sides win because I think that can be done. But we have to think about government and criminal justice and public safety as a business deal for the public, and that's really what it should be. And it can work extremely well if it is. But the bottom line is we got to quit talking about arresting 15 more people with nowhere to put them and no way to treat them when we've got too many people in the system already. We've got to think about where is our money put that gives us the most bang for the buck.
I think, Judge, you're reaching your bewitching hour, but
yes.
Representative Tomei, I had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, how do you keep people in treatment?
Through a number of ways. First of all, I try to encourage them. I look for any opportunity to praise any success that they've got, because most of these people have not experienced that. When I get a report, I see them more often at the beginning. I try to convince them they can just go today. Don't worry about tomorrow. I may see them tomorrow and say, you know, how did it go? And if they say, well, you know, I showed up, I say, well, that's the start. You know, the journey from 1,000 miles starts with a single step. I talk about things that I think are unique to them. You know, what do they want to accomplish with their life? Do they think that somehow magically their life's going to get better when they're sticking a needle in their arm? You know, what family members pay any attention to them anymore? Are there things you would, you know, dreams you have you would like to accomplish? How do you expect to get there? These people that are at this table are going to help you try to do that. And the only way you can do that is to show up. So my job is, in every possible way I can think of, I tell them stories. I'll threaten them. I'll lock them up for a day if I have to.
That's what I guess what I'm getting at. Are there threats that you can impose?
It's positive rewards and negative sanctions.
And what are the negative sanctions, Judge?
One that I use very frequently is I'll say, I expect you to be in treatment every day this week, and on Monday of next week, Tuesday of next week, I'm going to see you and you're going to go to jail for a day for every missed obligation you have between now and then. I don't want them to go to jail, and I tell them that. I don't want you to go to jail.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you a chance to prove to me that you're a stand-up person and that you can actually do this, in spite of everything everybody is probably saying about you and that you even feel about yourself. I think you can do this, okay? And then when Tuesday comes and they've actually gone, you can say, you know, I'm really glad I don't have to lock you up, and it saves the taxpayers money because I save a space in the jail. Whereas if I'd have had to impose a 3 or 4 or 5 day sentence, it would have cost us $89 a day. You know, it's a very effective way to do it, and it squeezes that tax dollar in effective ways that are far more cost effective for the public, and we actually get better outcomes as well.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you.
Judge Larson, I just want to compliment you and thank you for what you're doing. I did get to attend Judge Graves' Marion County Drug Court recently. It was amazing. And the discernment of which he approached those situations that you were just talking about was great. And I'd recommend you get a chance to sit through one of those. It was wonderful.
Yeah, they're actually, I can leave this. I only brought one copy of this, but DHS just in the last week or so printed out a facts and figures of drug courts sheet. And I can just leave a copy of this. Maybe you can duplicate it. It's loaded with a lot of interesting stuff. And it's funny that some of the best research in the country that's been done to date in terms of cost effectiveness and real effectiveness for comparative criminal justice systems, the regular system of doing it and the drug court system of doing it, has been done right here in Oregon and recently, and it's available online. Mike Finnegan's a researcher up in Lake Oswego. He's got a business called NPC Research, Inc., Anazin, Nathan, Paul, Charlie, and you can get that online. And it's overwhelming in terms of what it tells you and what it tells us about our Oregon system, because it was done right in Multnomah County, and it compared both the traditional processing system and the drug court system, and it's simply in keeping with all the other research that's being done all over the country that proves the same thing, and why some of the guys behind me were complimenting the drug court program. It doesn't matter if really pretty much who the judge is, does to some extent, but not really. It's the system that's employed that makes every part of the system work better and more effectively and get better outcomes for the public. And that's really, I think, what we ultimately are all about. And if you can do anything as a legislator that improves that, then that's where you ought to go. And I ask you to do that as a business decision. And I think if you start looking at this as a business decision of moving money from bigger pots to potentially smaller pots and into the treatment system, you'll find that you get much better outcomes. And we are grossly, grossly underfunded in the state for treatment, and we're reaping the whirlwind because of it. On the criminal justice side, I can tell you that our situation is really dire. It's dire.
Well, we appreciate you being here, Judge, very much. Incredibly engaging and compelling presentation. And I had a chance to attend the first graduation from Judge Graves' drug court it was last year, and it was a pretty impressive production. Those to see that journey that you talked about, beginning with one step, ending at, you know, at a place where people see the possibilities in the future, and it's pretty exciting to see them feel empowered. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
By the way, this will be part of that thing I leave, but it's a map. I forgot it was here. A map of Oregon and where the drug courts are right now, and there's a lot of them in the state, and they're growing because, you know, judges are finding out it does actually work, and they want to be more effective. And so I would urge you to be part of that success and take a look at the full measure of the governor's, not maybe just the governor's recommendations in terms of legislation, but the whole meth task recommendations, because I think as a full-scope legislator, you really have a need for what are the ideas out there that are being put forward that will work. And I think we came to you total unanimous consensus in terms of all of the recommendations that ought to be made, because every single one of them, regardless of which leg of the stool we were talking about, were things that we all knew would actually work and would be cost-effective as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much, sir. Yeah. Enjoy the party. Send your wife our best.
Hurry home.
Okay, we have one final panel that we'll invite forward, and colleagues, if you'll indulge us, we'll go a few more minutes and hear what these folks have to say. We have Tim McKee and Lucy Zamorelli and Ron Schwartzler. Is that right? You know what? We'll take just a 2-minute recess for a restroom break. Then. Thanks. Thanks, Andy.
Really
fun.
Great.
It's really fun.
There's an extra water here if anybody needs
it. All right. Thank you. We'll call that up. Committee back to order. And we are going to hear from Tim McKee and Lucy Zamorelli and Ron Schwartzler. So whoever would like to start. We'll start with Lucy.
Good evening. I'm Lucy Zamorelli. I'm the Director of Adolescent and Research Programs at Willamette Family, and I also am a consultant for the federal government, and I do grant reviews. And in my different hats, I've had the opportunity to visit lots of programs in various parts of the state and the country, and to do a lot of grant reviews. And I just want to speak in favor of House Bill 2500. I think it's extremely important that we have standards that are reasonable, that are doable, but that maintain atmospheres of healthy, productive services for adolescents. I think that we have to remember how vulnerable adolescents are and how many good-hearted people there are who want to help at-risk kids, but who aren't maybe coming from the same place of understanding the evidence-based practices, the research that we know is effective for working with teens. And I appreciate the good-heartedness of individuals and organizations, faith-based organizations, community-based organizations that have every intention of doing good, but it doesn't always go that way. And so I support the standards because I think it will really help to keep us on the right track with our programs for kids.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom McKee, Executive Director of Rimrock Trails Adolescent Treatment Services. We have a residential program in Prineville, and along with an outpatient program and outpatient offices in Bend, Redmond, and La Pine. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair Daltle, and committee members, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. It's been a good discussion so far. In speaking to House Bill 2500, I can tell you that the possibility in a short time that many juvenile detention facilities will need to be providing alcohol and drug treatment for youth if the residential system collapses in the state. And in my opinion, we're on the verge of collapse. My program is a small program. It was built out of community need, formed in 1990. We had the chief of police, and a local judge and other community members on the first board, and we've grown from 1990, but we're at a point financially that we can't continue on. Some weeks, especially around the 10th of the month, we have a payroll on the 10th, and I do a little dance out the mailbox hoping that that some insurance checks will come in so that we can meet payroll. And all our funds, our reserves are gone over the last few years, mainly because of meeting the standards and trying to give the best service that we can. We spoke about the pay that our workers receive in this field. I have a young lady working for me who has a master's in counseling, and she's making $26,000 a year. She's been making that $26,000 a year for the last 3 years since I've had her without a raise because that's all we can do afford to pay her.
Can't even pay for student loans.
No. You know, and she's still with us. Dedication. The problem that the adolescent programs are facing in the residential system is simple economics. We provide services that cost us around $200 a day per youth, and we get paid $113. If you take, and I submitted some written testimony here, but if you take the there's eight residential programs in the state for adolescents that are funded by the state that have state contracted beds. There's five of the programs that have 12 beds each. On average, those five programs need to come up with $35,963 a month to break even from other sources. The bigger programs are able to absorb it by taking money out of other programs and supplementing the adolescent budget. But a program like mine that just deals with adolescents, we're not gonna last. And there's a couple of programs that are on the verge in the state of going under at this point in time. There was a DHS submitted a policy option package to the governor recognizing this problem of underfunding in the adolescent system, and they suggested a $214 a day rate. That's the top of an average range documented in a 1999 study of costs for adolescent residential treatment. And the bottom line is, in order to get that raise and to keep these programs up and functioning, it's going to take $2,359,000 over the biennium to, and that's a big nut to crack, I know. Methamphetamine is a big problem. I'm a recovering addict myself. I actually graduated from one of those programs that Bruce was talking about in Coos County that closed up almost 20 years ago. I'm also was born into a tavern family. My dad owned a big neighborhood tavern in North Portland. The Goose Hollow Inn, I think, is in Representative Greenlick's close. Okay. I managed the Goose for a while for Bud. And so I've seen both sides of this problem. With alcohol, it's really easy to get sucked into methamphetamine addiction if you're out drinking and want to party, because alcohol is a depressant and brings you down. And if you want to continue partying, you can take a little bit of meth and bring you right back up and continue to party. And I saw that over and over again in my tavern. The youth that we're working with, over the last 2 years, it's increasingly they've come in addicted to methamphetamine. I did a survey last month of the eight programs and the adolescents that were in residential treatment in the state at that point in time on that during that week. And we had 82% of the youth in residential treatment had used methamphetamine. And then 54% of those youth come in with a dual diagnosis, come into treatment with a dual diagnosis. Meth really affects the brain chemistry, really affects the brain, and dual diagnosis issues, mental health issues, are a big problem that we need to deal with in residential treatment. And even though we need to deal with them and we treat them, and we do a damn good job, I believe, we don't get paid for it. One of the things on the facts here that I in the written testimony, state psychiatric residential programs for youth are contracted through the state. They average $268 a day as their bed rate. We get paid $113, yet we're dealing with the same youth and the same kinds of problems. So I just urge you, and I've taken this message. I'm actually glad Representative Butler isn't here because this would be old news to him. I've been bending his ear quite a bit. I've known Representative Butler for about 5 or 6 years now. But I've given this information to the Ways and Means Subcommittee and to the co-chairs. I just urge you to think about this, that these programs for adolescents are going to start closing. And my program will probably be the first. Maybe that's why I'm so passionate about this right now. We're not going to get to the bottom of this problem, treating addiction in this state, if we eliminate one part of the continuum of care.
Got it.
It's usually someone out here that has a phone going. So I just urge you to think about that. I urge you to pass this bill out of committee and support it on the floor because probation departments around the state and juvenile detention centers are going to have to start dealing with the youth. They're going to have to keep them in detention longer. And they need, if that's going to happen, they need to be provided adequate services. And the way the law is now, that isn't necessarily going to happen. So thank you.
Representative Boone, thank you.
How many people do you have in your program?
We run, in our residential program, right now there are 16 youth. We go up to have a 24-bed capacity. Rarely are we at 24 beds. Our state contract is for 12 beds. So the ones that are in treatment above that 12 are private pay and insurance, and those are the ones that keep our doors open at this point in time, because it's just there's no other way of doing it. And that's the other thing is that the squeeze is on from the insurance side of things, too. I urge you to support the parity because we get maybe 10, 12, 15 days of insurance out of the kids that we have in, and we don't kick them out when those 15 days are over with. We put the parents on a sliding fee scale. Sometimes we see that money. Most of the time we don't. And we keep them in as long as they need to be. and we use the standards in the ASAM, and there are pretty clear standards on when you need to discharge someone to a lower level of care or to a higher level of care. And we follow that religiously. So I don't know. Did I answer your question? I've almost forgotten what
no,
I was.
You did.
Okay.
You did. And what? One more. What's the success rate?
Well, that's it's hard to measure. It's hard to follow the kids, follow the families.
A guess. I mean, would you see them again, the same kids?
Sometimes we do. I can tell you nationally and for addiction treatment that about a third of the people that enter treatment will relapse during the first year of their recovery process. Another third will relapse several times, maybe over a period of years, back into addictive use, and then hopefully enter and maintain recovery at some point in time. And a third are like me and stay in the recovery process from the time they enter treatment they're on. So that's just a general rule that seems to be pretty accurate. I don't have actual statistics for my program. I don't have the money to track them. And they come from all over the state, and trying to find them 6 months after they leave treatment or 3 months or even 2 months after they leave treatment is a tough job, although we've tried.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, we talked some tonight about prevention,
mm-hmm.
the three legs of the stool. Mm-hmm. You work with adolescents. Mm-hmm. How young are the folks that you work with?
I'm not actually licensed to work with them. I've worked with 10-year-olds
So
on a crisis basis.
Could we talk some about prevention?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if a young mother is pregnant, we want to treat her so that we can prevent her child from becoming addicted. But when you're working with children as young as you are, what would be helpful for us to know about prevention?
Well, that's a big topic. I think that prevention is an essential part of what needs to happen, and early intervention in the addictive process, because it is a process. The sooner people get an intervention made on them, they don't have as far to go.
Right. If I could follow up. So
yeah.
A 10-year-old,
mm-hmm.
how could we have helped prevent that 10-year-old?
Well, that's dealing with the family.
Mm-hmm.
More
okay.
Nine times okay. out of 10. Adolescent treatment has a real strong family component. However, we're up against a wall with adult treatment and the funding for adult treatment. If there is an intensive outpatient for the family and then they have their own addiction issues, you know, we end up looking for alternative placements for these youth.
So are you finding then that especially the young children that you're working with, are you finding that their families are also addicted?
Absolutely. Most of the time.
Can I follow on that question?
Please.
Yeah, Representative Tomei. One of the things that we've learned in the area of health policy is if the parent doesn't have health insurance but the kid has health insurance, they get the kid in to see the doctor, and then so sometimes the parent will also, you know, use that, take advantage of their dental, if that happens
mm-hmm.
as well. Dental. Is that also the case in this treatment?
It happens, yes. We deal with them as best we can. If there's no funds for treatment, we provide what we can in a family setting.
I'd love to address that. I mean, one of the things that sometimes people don't realize with adolescent treatment is that with adult treatment, you more or less have one client. And, you know, you may have some children, you may have some family members, but they're pretty peripheral. With an adolescent, you don't have one client. You have however many clients are in the family. You might have six or eight clients with each adolescent client, because you're dealing with siblings, you're dealing with parents, often grandparents, especially in the addicted family system, and then you may be dealing with the child of the adolescent as well. And so it's one of the reasons adolescent treatment is so expensive is that you're dealing with a system with each adolescent client, not an individual. And prevention is so much a family affair. It's just unbelievable how working with an adolescent can change the lives of all of those eight people, a younger sibling who you know, perhaps would end up in prison as an adult, doesn't end up in prison, makes it through school, graduates. Sometimes we have stronger connections with siblings than we do with clients, people who stay in touch. So I think that the real shame in Oregon with our limited adolescent treatment, especially our limited residential treatment, because often families need respite from a really dysfunctional, addicted teenager, and a few weeks, a month in residential treatment can make all the difference for all of the kids in that family.
Yeah, Philip.
Yeah,
thanks.
Terrific.
And maybe this is true for everybody here, but I'm really interested in prevention before. It sounds like what we're talking about is a family that is already involved in drugs. So I guess I want to step back from that. So what can we do before a family or a child gets involved in drugs? So I'm really interested. If anybody has any information, maybe you don't have to present it tonight, but send it to Chair Dalto or send it to me. I'm really interested in stepping back and seeing what it is that we can prevent that child, that family, from getting involved in drugs.
I would just say keep that perspective, because I think that the joy of working with adolescents and kids, you know, I'm lucky because I work in this women and children's facility where we work with the little kids right on up, you know, age 0 to 18. We can change so much when we're working with youth. They are like sponges. They're so much wanting to have lives, to be adults. They see, you know, functionality as a challenge, but they don't reject it. You know, they're not hardened, and their sense of what they can do in the world is still so wide open. And
kind of like young legislators, by the way.
Well, what's really funny is, you know, I work with at-risk kids, but I have two teenagers at home, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. Let me tell you something. They're the same kids. I teach the 9th and 10th grade at the synagogue here in town. They're the same kids. They're all bright, they're beautiful, they're eager to get out into the world. And if we can present them with opportunities that don't, you know, focus on the drug culture that they're used to, or the sexual culture, the sexualization that we see with young girls, if we can give them challenges in education, which we do in residential treatment, they go to school, they have to go to school, they get health classes, they get health education, contraception, family planning, and this wealth of information that, you know, as a family, my kids get because they're, you know, sort of normal kids in the culture, but at-risk kids are in this sort of hidden culture that we've got, this sort of underground culture from drug-addicted families. They're hungry for knowledge and for opportunity, and they find those opportunities in treatment. And they make enormous change in their lives, enormous.
I have a question. We've also heard from the committee in our informational piece about homeless and runaway kids, and from what I understand, there's about 6,000 in this state. So how do they fit into your programs? How do they get in connected to your programs, and how do they get the word, you know, from where they live on the streets and everything, and what happens?
We must have residential treatment for those kids. We must. We cannot expect those kids to make it on an outpatient setting. So we get referrals, say, from youth shelters or homeless kid programs. Kids know about our program, Tom's program, because the adults know about our program. So we constantly have, you know, girls coming into Willamette Family saying, well, my friends told me to come here, that if I had to go to treatment, make sure I get into Willamette Family, because that's what they hear from the adult users on the street, from substance abusers who get clean, go to this program, go to Rimrock, go to Willamette Family, go to Adopt. So, you know, the reality is we can serve those kids, but we have to have safe housing for them, and we have to have centralized, focused services. That's what they get in residential. there's so little residential capacity that it's a trickle of those kids that we can intervene on in their lives. It's not because we don't know how to do it. It's because they don't have money, they don't have resources, and we don't either.
Okay. Go ahead. Representative Greenlee with the last word after that.
Because I wanted to comment, and I know Judge Larson had to leave, but one of the things that he was saying and was very passionate about was be careful what we do with these 75, whatever they are, meth bills. And from what I understand, what they are going to try to do with them in committees are combine a lot of the things and all that. And there's a lot of permutations that will come out. But if we do that, and we're even being cognizant of the fact that we may be increasing the load on your programs, what wouldn't we do? Why, you know, how can I say this? How could we not do that? How could we not address the problem there and just say we can't do this because we have to just leave everybody out there that's doing it and treat the ones we've got?
Well, I think I would just encourage you not to set policy if you don't have resources to back it up.
Tim, did you have something to say?
No.
Okay. Representative.
See, I hate to end this on an even lower low, but I think you've had the kind of experience that you might comment on this. There was a comment that methamphetamine leads to hypersexuality, and one of the issues that's been so disturbing to me in the adolescence is the whole question of the link is the whole question of the link between methamphetamine and these adolescents in the sex trade, and that's both male and female adolescents in the sex trade, as being maybe the most disturbing element of it all. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on this just a little bit?
Sure. I think it's a piece of the puzzle. When we look at kids in the sex industry, we're looking at a situation where we have within the home a wonderful training ground for future sex workers. We have young, vulnerable children who are being abused, neglected, sexually molested. They are being taught to not defend themselves. They are being taught to dissociate. They are being taught that they are crazy, that there is something wrong with them. They begin to identify as dysfunctional and dysfunctional sexually. On top of that, they get a little bit older and they start to use a drug like methamphetamine, which, or alcohol or pills. I mean, all the drugs do kind of the same thing. Meth tends to really promote a bit of a hypersexuality. I think it's a piece of that anyway, but what we see are kids who are in prime position to be exploited by people who know exactly what they're looking for in those kids. They look for vulnerable, sexually abused, hopelessly mentally ill, disabled kids, and they pull them into an industry that seemingly promotes them, raises their self-esteem, gives them something to feel good about, gives them a small amount of money, and puts them out in the world in such a way that they identify as, very positive. I think that, like the gang structure, the sex industry is one of those hidden pieces behind our homeless kids and our at-risk youth, and certainly methamphetamine, as well as all substances, play a part in the what we can sometimes not understand, why the kids go for this. Why do they let this happen to them? Well, they've been well trained to be good sex workers, Representative Greenlee. I think that we're looking at the methamphetamine is a piece in that puzzle, but it's certainly not the only piece.
Representative, could I add something to that? We probably make 3 to 4 mandatory reports a month just out of our residential program on sexual abuse. We know the state police officer by first name that comes out and does the interviews. It's a big, big part of what's going on with the youth.
Representative Boone, last comment.
Okay, and I can't let it go. I'm sorry. It's just been... You said it, Lucy. You said it. So What we need to do is go after these guys that are doing this, and we're not. We're not doing it. And so what happens is that message gets out there, and, of course, the children are being made the victims, and that says to them that they are the perpetrators, and these guys are getting off scot-free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
How can we do this? How can we put this thing together and get them?
Well, I like the three-legged stool idea. I think that we've got policy, we've got education, and then we've got services. And I think that, you know, through sort of a concerted effort, when we all work together, I think we really do make a difference. I mean, I know I have to believe that, or I couldn't do this job. But I believe that when I work with a girl and I help her see that, no, she's not, you know, she doesn't have to identify as a sex worker, that she isn't useless, stupid, dumb, worthless, and that, in fact, you know, she can grow, she can be a vibrant part of the future. I know that our outcomes are good. You know, because we have a CSAC grant, which is very frightening, is going to end in 6 months. We are following our clients for 1 year. And what our outcome results show is that about 80% of our teenagers have no further treatment episodes and no further problems with legal problems, no further run-ins with the law. So that's 80%. That's pretty good. Of the 20% that we're either missing or we know they're back in jail or we know that they're having major problems, I still believe even that 20%, a lot of them are never going to be in the situation they would have been if they hadn't gotten some treatment. Almost without fail, I think we see that almost 100% of clients who go through treatment end up in a better place than they were before treatment.
Well, that is a hope. A hopeful note.
It's very hopeful. We just, you know, we just need more.
Lucy, Tim, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the audience that didn't get a chance to sign up that wanted to say a few words before we close? Okay, come on. Yeah. We have to head back up, but come up and share with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, community members. I'm Dr. Ron Schwarzler, currently medical director at Serenity Land Health Services, nonprofit organization for alcohol and drug treatment. We have a residential treatment center here in Eugene, plus outpatient treatment centers in five major cities across Oregon. I'm a family practitioner, and I hope you all have family doctors and primary care physicians out there. I don't want to speak in their behalf and on behalf of physicians in this state. I was born and raised in this state, born in Portland, raised in Portland, and thanks to the educational system in this state, I was given a very good education, went to medical school here. Went off to training and went to Vietnam, became addicted at that point. That was the start of my addiction. I've been in recovery for a number of years now. But when I returned from Vietnam, my determination was to treat the citizens of Oregon and come back and give back to the people in Oregon what I've been given. I practiced in Clackamas County, Marion County, for over 30 years. Currently, this lab took a horizontal move and went into full-time addiction medicine 5 years ago. Currently, I'm president of the Oregon Society of Addiction Medicine. You've heard ASAM being mentioned, American Society of Addiction Medicine. I'm currently chapter development chair for that program to get physicians involved in addiction medicine throughout the country and particularly in the state of Oregon. I want to be brief because I know you guys want to head back, but I just want you to know that this is a very treatable disease. I'm a perfect example of that. And I've been put back into my position as a physician, and I'm grateful for what I've been given in various treatment centers and the recovering people in this state. We have to remember that this is a treatable disease, just as diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. It's a very treatable disease. If you have a primary care physician that you see, if he's seeing 40 patients a day, he's probably seeing 10 or 12 people that are impacted by this disease. Their children, the parents, the spouses, the brothers and sisters, and the grandparents. And all those people that he sees, he has no resources sometimes to get those people into treatment, whether to treat the family. And he treats the physical symptoms of those people who are suffering. So I want you to know, and I want to reiterate just what everybody says. I think we do need more treatment in this state and whatever we can do. We've heard a lot about methamphetamine. You have to realize it's a big problem in the state about prescription drug dependence problems. We have figured one out of three adolescents have tried a Vicodin, an OxyContin, a methadone, one of those substances. You could go on the internet when you get home and go to Google and go to Vicodin, get any drug you want off the internet, mailed to your house. We have a huge problem with that. We have a huge problem with alcohol. These people that use methamphetamine always use alcohol or marijuana to come down from their methamphetamine. So I want you to realize that this does impact a lot of people. And whatever the physicians in this state can do, I think, to help spread the word. And you mentioned about prevention. I think it has to come from the grassroots level. I think physicians have to be involved. I think all our people who care for people, our nurse practitioners, our physician's assistants, our nurses, all need to be involved in educating people about this disease. The biggest source of educating people are people in recovery. You have to get people into recovery that have been in recovery to go out to the schools, to go out to the communities and share their experience, strength, and hope, which we do as small groups, and to show that this is a treatable disease. I want to thank everybody that I think you had some really good input from that, and whatever the physicians in the state can do, we're more than happy to help.
Thank you very much. Thanks for sticking it out with us.
Yeah.
With that, colleagues, just a couple things. We'll bring House Bill 2500 up for work session as soon as we can physically put it on the agenda. We didn't have it scheduled for work sessions today, so that'll be sometime next week. And I just want to thank everybody who presented and the members in the audience who didn't present but were here to listen, and also thank my colleagues very much for sticking it out on a very compelling presentation. So have a safe trip home. We'll adjourn this meeting.
Sandy, how long is it going to take you to...